I don't know how this is going to work, but it's going to have to try. So we'll see. This is a different arrangement. Try to.
You can do it.
Think so? I don't know. I think we might be highly annoying to the people over there, and vice versa. We'll see. We'll see who collects here. Okay, well, we're studying Proverbs. This is lesson number. Things that shows up today is just what the book's like and what it's about. Remember that the very first we had chapters 1 through 9 were an elaborate introduction to the book of Proverbs, contrasting two women. And we said that you don't want to, of course, miss the gender thing that's going on there, but at the same time recognize it's a metaphor. I mean, it's describing one as the course of wisdom and the other foolishness and all its seductions and all its charms. Where are we? Almost up to 22. You've got the Proverbs proper of Solomon. And they could actually be divided into two. You might put them in two parts. We said that the first part of them had a lot of disjunctive proverbs. Do you remember that? That we said proverbs are pithy little statements, 2 to 4 lines, meant to be memorable, meant to be visual, sometimes meant to be really humorous. But the first batch of in sharp contrast to what was imaged next. Now, it's not infallibly true, but generally true. The second part of the Proverbs proper of Solomon there, they tended to be what are sometimes called together to form a conclusion for you, and so they're a little bit different. But then, now today, we're in chapter 22, and we've come around a bend a little bit with the Proverbs here, and I'll get not thinking about it or not knowing enough, you would say, well, Solomon wrote the Proverbs. And you think, well, I believe Solomon did invent Proverbs, if you will, or capture them. But the indication is that he was also a collector of Proverbs. And what we have in the book of Proverbs is both those that come from Solomon and those he collected, and those that were added later, apparently, by Hezekiah, that seemed to be in the spirit of jump, and we'll get even 2 more sets of Proverbs by other kings there. I don't think you should Solomonic from beginning to end. I don't see why you'd worry about that. The Bible doesn't insist on that. That would be a very simple reading of the book, and clearly it's a text. Presence. Also, when we've collected things from other worlds, and we'll see that big time. There was a big crisis in this new building. I just said, I don't know, maybe we need an annex. What do you think? We need to start talking about additions here. Anyway, when I said that Solomon collects these things, clearly he reserves the right then to edit them. He puts the stamp of Jewish faith on them, if you will. I mean, he makes them yield to the God of Israel, and we'll see that. Now, one of the things we'll see in 22, and let's just, why don't we open to Proverbs 22. Now, why doesn't somebody read us, let's see, the jumps in the middle of the chapter. Remember, chapters are man-made devices. They're not part of the scriptural record. I mean, they were really from the Middle Ages. It should probably be between 16 and 17. In 16, the Proverbs proper of Solomon seem to be come to a close, and a new element opens up in the book. So 22, 17 through 20, would somebody read this to us? introducing something here. Incline your ear, hear the words of the wise, and apply your heart to my knowledge. This would be jumping back. We've been in standard pithy Proverbs up to this point. Now, the sayings of the wise, that sounds like a collection. And in fact, what we've found here in chapter 22 to 25 is this matches very, very Meniope. You can go online, find e-texts of Meniope's wisdom. Now, remember we said that Solomon seems to have a pipeline to Egypt. What's the pipeline Solomon has to Egypt? His wife, who is Egyptian. Just any old Egyptian. Proverbs, that it's nobody denies it at this point. I mean, there's no way to get around that. I mean, they're not just similar, they're identical. Now, that led to a controversy. To say, well, then it would only be a critic of the Bible who would say that Meniope came first, that Solomon came, maybe Solomon came first and Meniope was the copier. Well, that would be a sound thing to think about, right? Just because there's a similarity doesn't mean it's coming that way. It could be going that way. Yeah. Get what I'm saying? I didn't say that real well. But in any event, the trouble is that they found copies of Meniope's wisdom going way back into like quite a bit earlier than Solomon's life. I mean, almost back to the time of Moses, copies of this work. So apparently it's very ancient and precedes Solomon by quite a few generations. As I said, it doesn't seem to be of the God of Israel on them and interject the God of Israel and several of them by name. Thirty sayings you read, Colleen. That was one of the keys, because one of the things there is that Hebrew was extremely difficult to translate, and it was all over the place in different translations. And when somebody was looking at the Egyptian and saw that it was mapped out in about 30 short paragraphs, 30 little containable elements, they thought, oh yeah, we'll look at this Hebrew again. Yeah, this is mapped out in 30, and that's indeed what the Hebrew says. There are 30 kind of elements to this wisdom that are here. So it's very interesting. Anybody want to reflect on that? I starts and dies with us. But actually we looked at the very beginning of Proverbs, we said that there's actually a lot of respect in the Bible for the wisdom of other lands. And in a sense, even when they're complimenting Solomon's wisdom over and above theirs, it's sort of tipping their hat to them, you know. Vindicated by all her children, and that works. Now, we'll find that these oh, come on, we've studied them. Like a gold ring in a pig snout is not just any woman. Righteous man regards the life of his, but even the tender mercies of the wicked are what? Cruel. You know, they were meant to be memorable like that. Rob had one today that we didn't get to do. I didn't like the translation there, so it's about a dog. Do you remember it?
You've lifted a mad dog by the ears, right? It's the tiger by the tail. I mean, what do you do?
But they're all pithy. Now, what we say is, they're also, we said in Solomon, is even though there were recurrent themes and they bunch up a little bit, you kind of have to, there's a kind of almost random quality to the ordering. And so remember, we kind of took topics and put them down in columns, but we were going through all those chapters to put them in those columns. They aren't meant to be read and digested all at once. They're meant to be mulled over and thought about. We find that something different is happening here in 22:17 with the sayings of the wise. We're back away from the pithy proverbs of 2 to 4 lines, and we're back to kind of paragraph form. Off the tongue. I heard one commentator say, once again, a hand is on your shoulder. There's somebody telling you a little more what to think. If you notice those Solomonic proverbs, it doesn't get pedantic. Do you know what I mean? Lifting a stray dog by the ears. You know, that means, you know, if you hold, we can't let it, you know, you're kind of explaining it. Well, most of those proverbs aren't explained. Bit of what he means. And so we'll see that here. So let's look at some of this. Very intriguing to me what's here. Let's talk about what appears in, let's go right over to 23. And would somebody read 1 through 3 for me? Sit down. What's it about? Gluttony. What's that?
Gluttony.
Yeah. But in particular, where? It's really intriguing. There are actually several of them. Now, remember who we said, who is the original audience, in a sense, of the Proverbs, as far as we can tell?
Courtiers,
right. They're going into diplomatic service. They work in a realm where banquets and dining are a big deal. I mean, that's where you schmooze, right? That's where the deals are cut. That's where you win favors. I mean, you know, become a diplomat even now and work for the State Department, and I'm guessing you go to a lot of dinner parties. Dining with whom? The ruler. Does everybody have ruler? All right, now let's come back to that. Think about that, because you have to think, what does this have to do with me, for heaven's sake? So I'm a follower of Jesus Christ in Ohio. I haven't been invited to dinner with a king lately. So let's look at that. Let's look at 23:6-8. Somebody read us 23:6-8. Okay, so dining proverb number 2, 23, what'd we say? 6 through 8. So, miser. I had miser, yeah. What did you have?
Selfish.
The selfish, yeah. So what are we going to put here? Let's vote on our guest. What's that? Have you ever been to a dinner like that? I mean, you know, can you say that without compromising? Have you ever been at a table in which you really felt like there was something else going on there and it was uncomfortable? Yeah. I have. I mean, it's a weird thing to sit there. All right, so let's come back. We'll come back and hit each of these here and see what's there. Let's go to 23. 20 and 21, and it's the third dining parable.
Do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat, for drunkards and gluttons become poor, and drowsiness clothes them in rags.
What clothes them in rags?
Drowsiness.
Drowsiness clothes them in rags. All right, so dining proverb number 3 is dining with whom? Yeah. Dining with drunks. It's got a nice. Yeah, rebel.
A drunkard and a glutton can be a well educated, well positioned person for a while.
A glutton.
A glutton. We're going to go with glutton. Okay. All right, so this is really interesting. As I said, let's go back now and go through this, because you say, well, I'm a Christian in Ohio 3,000 years later. Well, even more. I mean, we could be 4,000 years later. So it's Amenhotep, the Egyptian, is the guy behind all this. And we're not invited to dinners with rulers, but what are you going to walk away from with this proverb? I mean, it's God in his wisdom put this in your Bible. And I don't think he put it there just as an historical footnote. So what are we going to say? How will you apply the teaching of dining?
I feel like you owe someone something.
Aha. Yeah, I think we're getting to the heart of it there. This is about power and seeking power. I mean, this is sucking up to the person who can dispense favors, right? And it comes at a cost. You could be lulled in. This person has the delicacies, but the advice is severe. I mean, what is it? Put a knife to your throat. That's really that's pretty harsh advice. Now, yeah. What he said. I agree with it completely. I mean, politicians, for example, love to invite clergy people to prayer breakfasts and things like that, and you feel like you've got a voice and an influence in. Yeah. Yeah, it's very, you know, David and Daniel and the three, when they wouldn't eat the king's delicacies, they went with water and vegetables and looked better. Interesting. Well, it seems to me you can push that one out pretty far, can't you? And what's the advice there? I don't think we're supposed to cut our throat. What are we supposed to do? Yeah, well, it's very interesting that the delicacies keep coming up, right?
Yeah.
Three. He's got an ulterior motive.
Okay.
Right? He's using you. Okay. He wants you to walk away and feel that he's generous, but in fact, it's not at all. I've never had this happen. I've had some weird dining experiences, but I've never had that one.
It feels like they're delicacies.
I think 8 and 9 are wonderful. The morsel you have eaten, you will vomit up. And I don't think he means it literally, of course. I mean, I just think that you'll be sick by what just transpired in this deal. You've been, once again, you've been played. You've been used. And your pleasant words will have been wasted. You'll have sat down trying to be a gracious guest and have spoken. Very interesting. Once again, how do we apply it? And then the gluttons, 20-21. What's going to happen to us there, and what are we supposed to do? Yeah, well, I think the idea of bad influence there, right? I mean, situations like that capture you and bring you down too. Well, I think it's very interesting to think about these things. Say, well, how do I apply this, and how do I look at it? Well, I think
can't have dinner with anybody.
I'd come to your place. I don't think you'd be. I don't think you'd be playing me like this. Through 35. And once again, this is, think about who it's addressed to. Would somebody read us 29 through 35?
Who has woe? Who has sorrow?
Okay. So we had our dining proverbs, and now this is our what proverb? Drinking proverb. Now consider once again the diplomatic corps, the young men going out at dinners, at extensive parties. You'll remember that in a lot of these courts in at least the ancient Middle East, you couldn't abstain. I mean, it wasn't an option. I think you see that a little bit in the beginning of the book of Esther, don't you, with Ahasuerus? And they're all getting progressively plowed all over the kingdom. I mean, they have a feast that's going on for a long time, and apparently not drinking is a particularly offensive thing. So I don't know that they give an option to a person who's the king's pouring your drinks, you drink them, and that's it. Now, here's a question. I don't at all mean to start a fight with this particular part of the conversation, but what do we think of this? I mean, what is this proverb telling you as a Christian in the 21st century? Well, let me just ask the million-dollar question. Do you believe drinking alcohol is a sin?
I think the word linger means a lot.
So lingering is a sin.
Lingering in the wine. Over the wine.
You were saying?
No, as long as it's not an
accident. Both. I mean, it's somebody who gets trapped in it and becomes addicted to it. Well, you know, if you're in the category of those who feel all drinking of alcohol is a sin, I respect you for it. I recommend a life of non-use of alcohol. It's been my standard speech. But one thing I do have trouble with is the idea, biblically, that it would be a sin to drink alcohol. I mean, I think that's far-fetched, biblically. But yet it has been the teaching of lots of Mennonite churches, for example, including the Bible college that I teach at for a long time. That simply, the wine referred to in the Bible was non-alcoholic wine. Jesus would never drink wine. Paul would never drink wine. They were talking about something else, you know, grape juice. You know, frankly, they're stretching it really badly historically. But I understand. It's a big question. You'll know that the Christian church, of course, goes along, and then it's... People have been known to be abstemious about alcohol. They were brewers and distillers. As a matter of fact, the joke is there's a an elder in the Mennonite church in Scottsdale, Pennsylvania, named Abraham Overholt, and he made rye whiskey
And it was about this time of the temperance movement in the sell his distillery, his Overholt whiskey. It was the only rye whiskey distilled in the United States. Well, they pushed him and pushed him and pushed him on it, and he finally gave in, and he sold his distillery. I think Seagram's was the distiller at the time who bought it. But he failed to hold on to his trademark, and so he remained on the and in every bar you had an old Overholt, it was called. Overholt, sir. And there was Abraham right on the label of it. He looked too Mennonite for a lot of people, so I guess Seagram's doctored the picture and gave him a little bit of a smile, because he was just, you know, looked like one of us, you know. But that does show you what's happened in the Mennonite church. I mean, the temperance movement grabbed hold of the Mennonite church hard, and took it and carried it right up until recent. Don't buy it. You know, they're moving back towards social drinking. My guess is that the point at which they start to see drunkenness and alcoholism again, they might have some second thoughts. Fires on them a little bit, you know, in some ways, or at least they approach it without a vivid sense of what does this mean when they do really see a person with woe, sorrow, contentions, complaints, and wounds, the person who gets drunk only wakes up to go seek another drink. I mean, I know names and faces here, you know, when I see that, because I didn't grow up in that world. You know, I grew up in that world, not the Christian world. I'm always pains with my students going, well, all right, yeah, I don't think drinking alcohol is a sin, but I see names and faces when I think of alcoholics and drunks and people even dying from alcoholism.
This is a good passage for
and every 10th seat was going to fall out of it. Would you get on the plane? Those kinds of. I get the feeling that the barbarian hordes have arrived. And we're 5 minutes early, but I think I'm going to retire early. We've got three more lessons now, and we've got plenty to cover. But think of this middle chapter, Meniope. It seems to be something Solomon's grabbed from Egypt and put the stamp of the Lord on. See you next week.